got this one here now.
I got the, agency and Xerox.
Well, we got a position paper?
You wanna come up to the table?
Thank you.
What are your department's recommended changes in the book?
Well, other than to answer any questions that might arise, I have 2 points that I would like to mention. And on the back of the fiscal note there, my last paragraph there stated that if House Bill 51 is passed, companion legislation to bolster the administrative staff to provide adequate protection of monies invested must be passed. That would give us additional personnel to handle the paperwork and the paper load that I expect to come in. Now, the other point is that right now, a veteran is eligible for more than one type of loan. However, the maximum that he can have is $100,000. Now, that figure of $100,000 is in the statutes, and that figure will have to be changed if this bill passes. If the figure $110,000 is a maximum, then that figure will have to show in the statute so that a veteran could borrow up to $110,000.
Which statute are you referring to?
26 Veterans Statute.
Oh, I see.
Par,
not,
yes.
Not 2615.
2615, yes.
Well, President, not the one that's in the bill?
No, it's a different paragraph, Mr. Parr.
Where is that found? Oh, I see. Is eligible for more than one type of loan.
Right.
It's a total, okay.
Well, 100,000, you see, that'll have changed to whatever figure you people come up with.
Yeah, it's the largest chart.
Right, yes, right.
So it'd be parent C.
Boy, I just don't understand how in the world the department can say, where'd that go? Did that really say that? Boy, I'd sure like to see what the experienced members of the Finance Committee would say if they saw the department estimating the modification of the existing limit by, increasing a loan amount of 20% and so forth. Would require an additional 9 people in the Veterans Affairs Office for origination and servicing?
Yes, sir.
Are you really kidding?
Well, I'm serious.
Oh, I'm serious in questioning that quite a bit. I can see if you were sitting in a private lending institution telling an executive of a bank that because you were going to increase limits on loans by the amounts indicated in this bill and you anticipated the a larger load that you're going to have 9 more people. I just hope that somebody suggests an amendment in the fiscal note. This looks like somebody's. Pardon me. My first impression, and I hate to say it, is that somebody's doing an end run using the old trick of using a fiscal note in order to get something that they may not have gotten in their original budget request through the governor's office of budget amendment. I just can't believe that. You're not talking about, you say you're only expecting a 20% increase in new loan origination and 10% refinancing, and I don't know exactly where you got those figures, but how they're going to result in 9 new state employees, I just can't believe that.
Well,
another clerk typist, a loan closure 2, a clerk typist 3, a loan examiner 1, a loan closure 1, so forth. Now, I'd be very interested. Are these? Could you provide this committee with information showing what your requests were to the governors, to your department, and then to the governor for new positions in your agency, and which ones were cut out, and to what extent there's a correlation between what's listed here and your original request?
Well, on the next year's budget, we only requested 1 additional personnel. Now, with the major changes being made, proposed, well, it's going to increase our program when we're going to experience a very large influx of applications.
Mr. Chairman, what's the average closing time?
Well, right now, we're between 30 and 40 days.
Well, then, if we didn't give you any people, any more people, but we affected the changes that you've proposed or seen proposed, then the worst that might happen is that the closing went to 120 days or something.
It might take as long as 3 months.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'd submit that we'd be doing a great favor. I mean, I think most of the recipients of this would like to see it raised, but I don't think they'd want to see 9 employees added.
Right now, the other lending institutions, your banks, have one person for approximately 240 loans, and a program right now we have one person for approximately 450 loans.
And what's their average closing time, sir?
Well, I think they take a little longer than what we do.
They take a little longer?
Yes.
You guys, wait a second. We've somewhat on a great efficiency thing that should be made known. In other words, you do 50% better job by in your servicing approximately 40% more loans.
Yes, see, I think with the banks or other lending institutions, you see, they sell their mortgages to a secondary market.
Oh,
so they have to find time to who's going to buy this loan before they even make it, you see.
Do you guys ever do that?
No, we sell ours directly to the Department of Revenue.
Do they ever sell them to anybody else?
No. With a low interest rate, if we sold our mortgages, we'd have to sell them at a discount. Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Isn't quite a bit of when you apply for a veteran's loan for housing, isn't that processed through a bank?
No, sir. We have direct financing here with the state.
We'll just go right straight to the vet's office.
Yes.
You think of the Alaska Finance Corporation, you go through a bank?
They do, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you guys are still at
7.5%.
So they're at 8%.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, a question. Does your fiscal note reflect that recommendation of another 0.25% interest? It does not reflect it?
No.
Okay, I was hoping not, because I don't think you're going to sell that. There was a big fight. Motley came in, what was it, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Wanted to raise it from 7 to 8.
8, yes.
We gave him a half, and it was very grudgingly done then.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think anybody might go wrong. This soon after raising it again.
Some of you, or maybe all of you, remember back in prior to 74, well, the major changes were made in the program in 1974, and shortly thereafter, because we weren't fully staffed, I wasn't there at the time, but it's taken as long as 6 months to consummate a loan because of the large influx of applications that hit the office.
What's the complement of the Division of Veterans Affairs now?
Well, we have dollar-wise 130
employees full-time.
29.
How many part-time?
That's it.
Any contracts?
No.
Just 29.
Yes.
And how many loans are outstanding?
We have 3,500 active loans for $130 million.
3,500 loans and 29 people.
Yes.
What was the amount?
130 million. Now we are loaning approximately $4.5 million a month.
You mean new loans?
New loans, 100 loans a month, averaging $4.5 million a month.
So 100. So if this passed, you'd be messing around with 120 loans, possibly. Well, I guess the 20% new loan organization and 10% refinancing. Does that take the same amount of time and paperwork?
Yes.
And all that?
Yes. Anybody comes in for what we call a renewal and increase, they have to process a new application, and it's the same procedure.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir.
Jack, did the legislature ever set a cutoff for eligibility when it extended to cover Korea and Vietnam?
In the statutes, there is a sentence that has to do with 6 months after hostilities have ceased, according to the federal government. Sir, some such, I'm not, but there's never been a cutoff for the state.
So that means that somebody who is entering the service right now can build his 90 days eligibility?
Yes, with the state, yes. Now the federal VA, of course, they are cutting back on their benefits.
Is the eligibility of the federal VA similar to our eligibility?
Yes.
Even to the National Guard provision?
No, the federal doesn't recognize a National Guardsman or a reservist.
Why?
Any such. Well, they just don't feel that those men were in the armed forces and that they're not eligible for the federal benefits.
What would make them think they weren't in the armed forces?
Well, you take an individual that was in the armed forces. He was taken out of his home. Maybe he was married and had a family. He was probably a few years ago, back in 1940s, why he was making only $21 a month. And he certainly had more hardships than some of the reservists that were maybe training during the weekend and still holding a job down in the meantime.
Why should the state of Alaska afford preferential loan treatment to the National Guard weekend soldier?
Well, that, of course, was passed approximately 2 years ago, and I just can't answer that question. I don't know what was behind it.
Wasn't the veteran loan program, of course, our chapter here calls it the Alaska World War II Veterans Loan Program, wasn't the concept, the idea, to give a preferential treatment to some person who had been taken out of the private sector and was serving his country, probably overseas, probably during a war, and this was to help him catch up at home?
That's right. That was the intent of the bill, yes, originally.
Right now, without judging the merits of whether the war in Vietnam was a good war or a bad war or no war at all, without judging the merits of a person who conscientiously objected to it, not making any comments on the merits, the simple fact is that a large number of people who, including my brother, who wanted to avoid the draft, joined the National Guard, didn't they? And most of them are proud that they did it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't they eligible under this program, and aren't they just as likely to end up with this loan as someone else?
That's true. The statutes show that the National Guardsmen and Air National Guard, and there's one other unit there that's mentioned, that if they have served 6 years or longer with an honorable discharge, that they are eligible for the program.
Doesn't it seem kind of ironic then that we have a program that's awarding or rewarding or either a person who is setting out to do exactly the opposite for which the program was created in the first place?
Well, you're getting in an area there. I don't like to...
Okay, I won't ask you to answer that.
I appreciate not answering.
Give you some background on that. The purpose, at least as I understand it, of extending the program to National Guardsmen, which was done 2 or 3 years ago, I'm not sure which, didn't have so much to do with rewarding prior service. But the intent was to be a recruiting and retention tool for the guards to attract people because of with the end of the Vietnam War, their ranks started thinning and they were having a real problem keeping people in the guard. And this was seen as one of the added incentives for people to not only stay in the guard, but to join the guard.
I wonder why, is that why we're keeping the end open? Is that why we're not closing the thing up?
I'm not sure why it hasn't been closed, but
Do you know? Why aren't we closing, for example, we set the parameters on what was a veteran in World War II, and we closed it off in 45. We opened it again in 64, but and the Korean War dovetailed with the Vietnam War, and in our legislation, we say that we will close it off 6 months after the end of hostilities in Vietnam, but we didn't and we aren't. Are we keeping it open as a recruiting tool for the National Guard?
Bobby, you're the big National Guard expert.
Yeah, what you typify with your brother is exactly my case.
Absolutely.
And I think what Chairman McKinnon said was primarily the reason, absent the politics in a small populated state and and a good chunk of National Guard guys, and could be the answer at the federal level, the southern chairman who has, but the people from Georgia and Mississippi have a tradition of going into service. They have a strong chairmanship in Congress because of seniority, and they have a strong lobby and stuff like that. And probably not too many of those guys go into the Guard and per capita type thing. Most of them go into regular service. But as far as not cutting off the date, I guess yeah. But if that would cut off that 6 year goodie, as a recruiting and retention, they're really hurting because they don't have the stimulus to go in as a legal dodge.
I'm going to, of course, vote unless it's amended some terribly unusual way. I'm going to vote for the a due pass on the bill. However, I think that we've got everything out of whack here. Number one, I think that we should close off the chapter, and if the National Guard needs a recruiting tool, and it probably does, and we probably do need a strong National Guard, that it should come through some other means than the Veterans Loan Program. It makes no sense at all. Secondly, principally a home loan program that is as attractive as the Veterans Loan Program, I would really like to see extended to all our residents or a large number of them, so that a young couple can take that step into a house and start to build their equity at an early stage here in Alaska. And it becomes kind of a farce administering that program through the Veterans Loan Program, though. It's warping the original intent. In fact, it's going 180 degrees the other way. The whole thing makes no sense to me.
Mr. Chairman, I want to vote for the bill, but I don't like the fiscal note. I have to presume that the gentleman is telling us what he believes to be the case and all that, but I just think that he is partly mistaken. I've supported state employees and been supported by state employees, but I walk into state offices, including offices. A whole bunch of people, just really overcome with work at the present time. I'm not quite sure whether or not the decisions that set the present level of the department were based entirely upon the needs of the program, so much as the political prerogatives of certain persons who have at least previously sat as the chairman of the finance committee in either body. And I wonder if this committee would be interested in essentially amending the fiscal note, because if we don't amend the fiscal note and the bill passes, then the pre-conference committee on the budget will include these amounts as mandated by the legislature before they close out the final budget document. That'll be it, baby. There we are. 9 more city employees. We may not have attended them. So.
Well, I guess how binding is the fiscal note? Because is question, I guess, that we have three options. All the people that have spoken, none of them have spoken in favor of the addition of nine new employees, the amounts indicated. I guess we could send a letter of intent saying that we don't think it ought to increase state employees, or we can amend the fiscal note, or I guess we could put something in the bill. I just tried on that health and social services last year and just say, you can do this, but we're raising it. We're doing whatever we're doing, but no new state employees. I just wonder what's the most practical, what would have the greatest effect.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe it would be practical for your staff to check with whoever is subcommitting the Department of Commerce budget, or at least the subject area that touches upon this loan program of House Finance, to see what their view really is as to the needs of the department and what they're also doing over there before we shoot the bill out. And then maybe we'll get a recommendation back in a day or two on the basis of which we can make a wise decision. Because if we don't, this bill does not have it does have a finance referral. Yeah. The chairman also have a directive, as four of us here know, to not try to put the load of all this kind of decision on the finance committees. So maybe we can inquire and make an informed decision within 1 or 2 days ourselves, and make a fiscal note ourselves.
Mr. Chairman, point of interest here to you gentlemen, the division operates on a revolving loan account. We have never received any monies out of the general fund to pay for the expenses of running the division. We've always ended up in the black each year. We're not there to make a profit, but if we do make a profit, we turn around and make that many more loans with whatever money we have. So if you're speaking a dollar wise, why the funds would not be coming out of the general fund.
Well, they won't be coming out of the general fund, but within fiscal year 1978, that means there'll be $182,000 that will not be available for loans to Alaskans under this program, and by fiscal year 1982, there'll be $219,300 that will not be available to loans for Alaskans under this program because you're bringing into over-increased employees. So whether those Alaskans are paying for it through their income taxes or just by a diversion of other state funds, by attacking the oil companies or somebody else they could have gotten other programs for, or in fact, in this case, there is less money available to make loans available to your program. I think it's all the same kind of thing. The money doesn't come from nowhere, it comes from somewhere.
Well, we sell our mortgages, as I mentioned earlier, to the Department of Revenue, and once again, a large impact. How much can a general fund stand, too? But see, we have a $50 application charge, and we get 0.5% servicing fee to service each loan, and we also get 0.5% a one-time service fee. Now, that's where our income comes from.
Plus the interest that you make on.
Yes.
Yep.
Do you have any idea what the geographic breakdown is on where you make the loan?
In the Anchorage area.
Largely in the Anchorage area?
Yes.
These seem to be doing quite a booming business, and yet the figures anyway indicate that with the $55,000 current limit, a normal 10% down
10%.
Payment, most people couldn't...
What we are finding, Mr. Chairman, are veterans that are having to borrow anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000 from another lending institution and possibly having a second on the dwelling to come up with enough for a down payment.
Right. Mr. Chairman, how much interest do they have to pay? I mean, you know, I guess 11, 12. Something like that.
Anywhere from 9.5 to 10.5, yes.
Well, that's a little surprising that a private lending institution would be interested in giving a second mortgage, a second security interest to a VA mortgage.
well, he'd go in for maybe a personal loan or something like that, then they'll just take a second on the dwelling.
Short term?
Yes.
Somebody once told me that anytime the state employees here in Juneau get a pay raise, that the prices go up. If the limit on the veterans loan program is raised, what aspect will that have on inflating housing?
Okay, back in, well, a few years ago, our maximum to loan was 44.5. And then it was raised to 55,000, and the prices of homes automatically raised $10,000 overnight.
Due to that?
Yes. Due to that bill. Your contractors and carpenters went up.
What credibility can you offer for that kind of statement?
Well, I wouldn't put it in writing, but talking to different people, why?
Do we have the same economics on down the next couple of years, do you think? We're at least entering a plateau, if not a dip. I mean, whatever you want to call it. I mean, your former boss and some leading economists said a plateau. But anyway, we're in for some sort of change, and we're experiencing that now in the economics of the state. And it seems... from what I understand, there are a lot of houses on the market. So are we going to necessarily, if there are these guys that are having trouble moving their houses now for the 70 grand or the 63, are they going to bump it by 8 grand or 10 grand just because this comes out now with the economy sort of, if you can project?
I believe they will go up some, yes.
You said you have a $50 loan application fee?
Yes.
How many loans applications do you receive statewide in a typical month, just to guess?
Well, we're averaging approving 100 a month.
Approving? Well, how many applications?
Well,
do you
that might be anywhere from 125 to 135.
So, suppose say it's 130. So that means you're receiving about $1,500 a month in application fees for people who pay to have you look at their application and then are not approved for a loan.
Yes.
So that's about $13,000 a year you're receiving in fees from people who pay you to look at their loan applications who do not get a loan.
Well, no. When a veteran goes into one of the regional offices, the loan examiner talks to the individual at that time, and he can tell by then, after talking to the veteran, whether his application would be approved or not. If it does not look like it would be approved for some reason or another, why, he doesn't submit an application.
Couple of questions, Jack. One, is it still a practice to require a loan applicant to submit a copy of his most recent federal income tax form?
Not as an individual. If it's a business loan, we require it, yes.
You did require it for individuals?
If he is working for himself, yes. If that's his sole income or support is working for himself, why then we will review the past 3 years, two or three years of his income tax statement to verify his income is such that he would be able to handle the debt structure.
When I applied for my loan in Fairbanks a couple of years ago, I was required to submit a copy of my income tax, my federal income tax form. And I was working for somebody else, not myself, and it was just a straight home loan.
Well, we usually don't require them.
I'm glad you don't, because I really question the propriety of doing that. And I'd appreciate it, in fact, if you would check to see if it's being done on
I will. I'll check.
Mr. Chairman.
Jim?
I don't have a question, an observation here. With the present level, present ceiling limits of $55,000, would appear to me that and the high cost of housing, that you wouldn't be getting an awful lot of activity presently. People just simply cannot. There are better ways to go than a VA loan. Primarily, at a minimum, the amount is, the ceiling is too low. You have to get a second, which requires the ability to get a personal loan, which is essentially unsecured. They may wrap it around on a second, but it would be short term and initially it'd have high monthly payments. So would occur to me right now that just to go along with what Fred says, that his observation that when he's popped into some of these offices, they aren't too busy. That would sort of stand. That sort of be reasonable. In the fiscal note, it says that anticipating increasing demand for new loans and rewriting existing loans at the above ratios, there's been an awful lot of volume. But it would seem to me that administratively, they could recognize there's going to be an increase in the number of requests. They could administratively, they could have a priority only for the whole idea maybe is to get people who don't qualify for any type of housing into some type of a home that they presently can't get into. Maybe rewriting existing loans could have a lower priority and subject to availability of funds activity, lack of activity for requests for new loans, so that this fiscal note could be pared down quite a bit.
Sean?
Ms. Tinsley, you were talking a while ago about the production your people have versus production in a typical bank, I think, a lending institution. Are we all both doing about the same thing?
Pardon?
Are you both doing the same things?
Yes. Similar. They have their real estate divisions within the bank.
I ask you a question because I know that a couple of years ago y'all changed over. For example, you stopped keeping a reserve account for insurance like you'd been doing. I think most of my impression is when you're wrong, the banks would still be doing that. They're doing at least a certain amount more bookwork, I would say, it looks like, than y'all are. I wonder if that had anything to do with their lower production rate per employee or something like that.
One of the major banks in Anchorage, for example, a year ago had 3,500 real estate loans, and they had 11 people handling their reserve accounts. That was insurance and taxes. And I had three people for 3,000 loans, and I just couldn't keep up.
Well, as I said, the point is, I mean, you dropped the
insurance.
The insurance completely, so it ought to cut your workload down. And I wondered about the comparison to the existing, structures, because they do have to take care of that as well.
We didn't cut any personnel back because we were never geared up to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have more personnel there now than you did at that time.
We do now, yes.
How many?
Well, we put 9 people on within the last year and a half.
All in the Anchorage area?
No. It's statewide.
So the situation now is as far as insurance and taxes go?
We still pay the taxes.
They still collect taxes.
Yes, yes.
Mr. Chairman, one other question. Do you know just offhand what the breakdown of that $130 million you have in force would be between home and small business and multiple dwelling, that kind of thing?
At the present time, no. We are in the midst of a conversion right now that will give us that information later on, but I don't have it today.
A few weeks, or?
I can get back to you later and let you know. Yes. One other thing I might mention, Mr. Chairman, there's a Senate bill number 4 that is being met on this morning, And that bill would change a multiple dwelling. A veteran would only have to have a 10% down rather than the existing 25%.
Do you know the number?
Senate Bill number 4. Senate Bill number 4.
I just didn't want to go to jail or to Canada.
I'm still somewhere.
I didn't have any
apartment business with this racket. I'm still a bit concerned about the fact that apparently here we have a program that's one step behind the market, and yet if we raise the limit, you know, maybe all we're going to be doing is keeping it one step behind at a higher bracket. If they're just going to raise
Well, I somewhat share that. It's pretty darn subjective.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe in the grab bank theory that what Mr. Tinsley foresees is going to happen. I mean, the other factors far override that. You know, the pipeline drop off, the fact that housing is overpriced. I don't know if Mr. Tinsley's office gets the impact center reports. Mr. Carpenter and I are both pretty familiar with them. We both are. We're both members of that committee up there. And that availability of housing curve has gone like that. You know, I mean, it's and the demand, the number offered for sale and the number of people buying is just upside down now. It's now a buyer's market in Fairbanks, and passing something like this would kick prices up $10,000 in Fairbanks. I don't believe it. That's all I can say. I mean, Anchorage, I have no idea about. Fairbanks, I just don't believe it.
I would think that, generally speaking, the law of supply and demand probably is overriding what the prices never seem to go down in the housing market unless you really have a horrible depression.
Well,
they go up. When the economy bottoms out, they just seem to hover around where they were, waiting for the next boom, and then they go up again.
Well, a great bulk of your housing cost is your labor, right? Much more than materials, and labor is not going to take a cut in pay. I mean, that's not going to happen. So they're not going to go down.
Our experience there, reviewing loans from the Fairbanks area, houses there are we're loaning on about average $65,000 a house up there right now. I realize it's a very soft market in Fairbanks, and it's a buyer's market in Anchorage today. But if we get into, say, a home loan of $75,000, I feel we're getting up there in an inflated price area that if we have to foreclose on a dwelling, that we're going to take a loss on it, possibly. I can see both sides of the picture.
I just don't think that this bill would cause an increase of $10,000 in the average price people are paying up here.
It's almost 10 o'clock, so I think Lewis gets together with finance on the fiscal note, see what their comments on them are, and then bring the bill up again in a day or two.
Mr. Chairman, one possibility, we could approve this fiscal note as it stands and just cut 9 people off somewhere else in the Department of Commerce. that's not entirely facetious.
Well, to be fair to Tony, he's about the only commissioner who really has cut stuff back.
Tony's gone.
Yeah.
We just have a memory.
Yeah. Let's do it in his memory. That's what we do.
Good morning. I'm Sharon Andrew, Director of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Commerce, and this is a Department of Commerce legislation, House Bill 105. So I'm here, obviously, to support it strongly. And I'd like to, if I may, point out some of the reasons that we believe that this legislation is necessary. Occupational licensing is a regulatory type of agency, or, you know, actually, in our instance, it's a number of regulatory agencies. And we believe strongly that necessary regulation, governmental regulation, frequently becomes excessive governmental regulation and works in an anti-competitive way by eliminating certain competitive opportunities to the practitioners, one of which is advertising. And we just believe that this is something that we need to take a strong look at and find out if it is actually in the public interest. There are a number of arguments when, you know, we've been looking at this for a year and a half now, and we have received a number of arguments from various members of the different professions. We think they're basically reducible to three. One, that price competition will result in quality deterioration. This is a concern that the professionals have. Most studies that we are aware of, or I should say all studies that we're aware of, but I'm going to say that we haven't reviewed all studies that have been done on a national basis, do not support that argument. Quite the contrary, they show that there is no correlation whatsoever between price advertising and quality of the product. The second argument is that advertising will allow the unscrupulous to easily mislead the unwary. This is true of all advertising. But I think that we need to bear in mind that we now have a number of other laws concerning this. Alaska has laws concerning truthful or untruthful or misleading advertising under its Fair Trade Practices Act. So we have both state statutes and federal statutes concerning that. We have the Office of the Ombudsman in Alaska. Not the least hammer that we have, if you want to say use that term or whatever, would be the licensing agencies themselves. Because even though advertising is allowed, the professional is still required under his own statutes to perform ethically and competently. So there is would still be, you know, for him to be engaged in untruthful advertising, misleading types of tactics, would constitute a violation of his own licensing statutes and would be subject him to disciplinary action. Oh, and I think the third, perhaps, argument that we find is the one concerning the painless Parker type of advertising, and I use that phrase. I think that Dr. Leonard Eukness will be here later to talk to you from the point of view of the dentists and perhaps the dental society, and I think the painless Parker concept of advertising is one that is very much searching for the right words, a concern of the professional groups. And this is the type of thing where, you know, come in and pain-free dentistry forever or, and get your teeth and your plate all in one tape a day. And I guess our only argument concerning this, because we can't say it won't happen because it has happened and I'm sure it would continue to happen, and as long as it weren't completely misleading or untruthful, there wouldn't be all that much that could perhaps be done to stop it. We would argue, however, that we need to find out or to at least ask if protecting a professional image is a legitimate use and exercise of the state's police powers. And we also feel that with this piece of legislation that allows the professional boards, the licensing boards, to establish guidelines and set these out as to what they would constitute fair and truthful advertising if for their profession would minimize this type of impact. As to the benefits to be gained, we believe we'll have a better informed public. We hope that we will have reduced costs for some of the services and goods that are provided. This has certainly been the case in other states, in areas where studies have been conducted, such as in prescription eyeglass prices, prescription drug prices. I'm not so certain as far as services, because in that sense, you get into legal services, and this would, by the way, affect the bar, although that's not a part of our division, but into legal services and medical services and dental services. I don't know if any advertising of prices in those areas has occurred at any time, so there's no studies to go by. An offshoot of reducing some of the costs would be an amelioration of the one of the side effects of high prices, which is no matter how blind I am, if I don't have the money to pay for the glasses, I don't get them. So if we reduce them, however, then I may be able to afford them. You put them into an affordable range. One of the serious consequences, I think, of of high prices in these areas is that people fail to obtain necessary services and goods because of, you know, economically they're on, you know, they're just not available to them. Then I think I would now like to leave that area and go on to our second major argument in support. Our first is we think that it's good for the consumer. Our second is that we think it's good for the state. And the reason we believe this is because of the increasing emphasis that the federal government, through various federal agencies, is placing on this type of state activity and action. The Federal Trade Commission Act has been amended. It's short titled the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Federal Trade Commission Improvement Act, which changes essentially the words in commerce, deletes them, and broadens them to in or affecting commerce, allowing the Federal Trade Commission at least to argue fairly effectively that they can move into the tiniest pharmacy anywhere, because if it affects commerce, they have jurisdiction. They are through the Justice Department, we have suits now pending against the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, the American Dental Association, investigations into the veterinary medicine industry, which are going to lead to Federal Trade Commission suits. The American Pharmaceutical Association has been sued, and we have some decisions also concerning this restrictions on advertising by professional associations and groups. I think the two of most importance at this time are the Goldfarb decision. This was a case involving the establishment of minimum fee schedules by the Virginia Bar Association. And it was considered to be, or the suit was brought under the Sherman Act, the Antitrust Act. The arguments the defendant's arguments were, I think, the two that have traditionally been used to sustain this type of legislation. One, that this is a state action, it was a state action type of regulatory program, and therefore exempt from the Sherman Antitrust Act by virtue of the prior decision in Parker versus Brown. Then the second was that as a learned profession, the bar was not subject to the Antitrust Act. And in the Goldfarb decision, the Supreme Court fairly clearly addressed those issues, very definitely narrowed the scope of the Parker versus Brown case by stating that in order for a state action exemption to exist, the state had to very clearly show that it was, the particular act was a portion of a definite regulatory scheme seeking to accomplish a legitimate state action, and so that in this case it didn't apply, and that furthermore the nature of the profession did not exempt it from the Sherman Antitrust Act either, so they threw out those two. The second case would be the Virginia Consumers Council or Citizens Council versus the state of Virginia and the Virginia State Pharmacy Board concerning the advertising of prescription drug prices. This is, I think, a landmark decision in that the Virginia Citizens Council was upheld. The prohibition on advertising prescription drug prices was thrown out or struck by the court. And this is based on the First Amendment freedom of speech, not the freedom of speech of the individual to advertise, but the freedom of speech of the consumer to hear. And it is a landmark decision, I think, in this type of litigation. And right now, we have in the state of Alaska, the boards of dispensing optician and optometry have been sued. The suit has been entered in district court in Fairbanks by the Alaska Legal Services, and this is to strike their prohibitions on advertising, price advertising. We find state of Alaska's Board of Optometry and Dispensing Opticians, those are both statutory, and this suit has been entered in federal district court in Fairbanks possibly 6 weeks ago. And the we're finding a trend, I think, nationwide to take a look at what's happening in this area. Bar associations are moving to relax their traditional, very strong restraints on advertising of any type. They don't even permit an attorney to list his specialty behind his name in the yellow pages. And at least our, you know, our physicians may do that, and our dentists can do that, but attorneys can't. But you find even, the American Bar Association, of course, has already proposed a relaxation of its rules. The California Bar has adopted on a partial basis a relaxation of its rules, and what it's done is it's either in two or three types of advertising are going to be permitted in sections within California, and then they're going to take a look at the results and compare them. So we do find a trend to change. We're concerned about the federal government moving in and dictating to states as to how we should regulate within our own jurisdictions. We think that we can do a better job, no matter how poorly we do it. We think we can do a better job. And we'd like to see this happen. Last year, when we discussed it with various professional organizations, societies, and groups, the response was, if it wasn't 100% negative, it certainly had to be at least 98% negative. I think that is no longer the case for two reasons. This bill is an improved draft of what we provided last year. This bill does allow for the professions or our regulatory agencies to establish good guidelines that can be used so that they don't, they're not so frightened of just the whole thing going wide open and becoming used car salesman type of thing. And I believe that they've had a more time to consider the implications of what's happening on a national scale. That is all that I have to say on the subject, but I would be happy to answer any questions.
This problem that you're hoping to cover by this House Bill 105, was that brought about by, did the governor's office become aware of this problem through consumer complaint or through the complaint of professionals who felt that they were somewhat hampered in their activities by not being able to advertise, or is it a combination of both, or just how did this this problem happen to get to the attention of the governor's office? Who is?
I don't know from the sense of whether or not he had an awareness of it before the Department of Commerce brought it to his attention. I don't know.
Who are the people that are indicating they have a problem and that are supporting this type of legislation? Is it the consumer who doesn't feel that he feels he's getting ripped off because he's not aware of the options that are available through different professionals who might take these consults out for $25 less, or is it the professional who would like to take it out for $25 less, or
in this,
who is the advocate of this? I mean, it's got to be one or the other, I would think.
I have not polled consumers in this state, and I certainly don't believe that I was ever approached by the professionals to introduce this type of legislation. I would have to say it's a matter of being aware of what is happening in the regulatory field. And under President Ford, one of his objectives was to reduce regulation, and I believe the Hammond administration has also stated as an overall general objective the desire to eliminate unnecessary governmental interference. And so from that standpoint, I'm going to have to say maybe it's we bureaucrats that started it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mrs. Andrew does not fit the definition of a bureaucrat.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
I'd like to ask a question about some of the language here. One of the things it says, it is unlawful for, and after listening to a bunch of other people, it says any government agency to adopt a woman or enforce or attempt to adopt them. Of course, any prohibition to advertise the application fees and prices. legislature can, by passage of this kind of a bill, impliedly include within governmental agency the Supreme Court of Alaska its power to promulgate the Alaska bar rules and regular conduct of attorneys.
Aye.
And why?
Speaking for the administration.
I believe that this bill would probably affect them, but I think that I would defer answering and ask that you ask that question of the, a representative of the Attorney General's office, who is much more competent to answer than I.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it does not. And I know that we've been all through this last year with respect to Mr. Bradley's attempts to provide for directing the court how to admit lawyers. It is still my opinion that the power of the court to regulate the bar derives from a constitutional power relating to the administrative rulemaking capacity, which I waved in your faces on the floor of the House about three times last year. And I very much sympathize with the direction of this legislation, but I think that unless this legislation is accompanied by something like a resolution directed to the court asking it involve itself in this area, it cannot be binding upon the attorneys, and I think perhaps it should be. I think that while there probably can be hideous abuses, I don't know if we want to have a neon sign flashing honest lawyer three flights up or something of that sort. At the same time, I think the restrictions have been way too heavy. I was one of the people who about 5 or 6 years ago was suggesting the Town and Valley Bar Association that they had abolished their minimum fee schedule because it was patently price fixing under the antitrust laws. And about 2 years later, they did for those very same reasons. And but it bothers me that I just don't think that the court would say that the phrase any government agency sitting right there by itself applied to the court is an inherent power to regulate the bar. Contrary to the views of some who now sit here, I do not think that the legislature has the power to override an administrative rule of court by a two-thirds vote. I think there's a specific case on the subject. And I think the Alaska bar rules come under the administrative rules of the court. I'd like to accomplish this result, I believe, but I think we're in the wrong forum when you're talking about regulating the attorneys.
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah, I have a question. Ms. Andrew, this is, you know, there's no problem with the beginning of this professional association, et cetera. And then you were attempting to include the boards that regulate the optometrists and the barbers and everybody else, right? That's on line 12 there, the occupation of professional mm-hmm. licensing agency. That what was intended to be included by the parts beginning at the end of line 12 and running into line 13 or any other governmental agency? What would that have been besides, let's say, the occupational thing listed on line 12? Who else might that be?
I think it might be the intended to cover the bar, which is not strictly an occupational licensing agency or board, and perhaps also to an attempt to be sure we covered everyone that we might have missed in the preceding language, Mr. Barr.
One of those things the attorney has put in to make sure you don't miss anybody, and to cover every possible loophole. Okay.
Any other questions?
It's a generic term to avoid it.
I was trying to think of that.
Well, may I ask one more question, Mr. Cameron? I didn't think before. Ms. Andrew, now you said last year you had pretty well unanimous opposition, and this year you think that's not true any longer. Are there any particular groups that are still, any particular professions or businesses or anything else that are still strongly in opposition? Which ones, if any, did you think that you know of?
Well, of course, we haven't had complete response to this bill in its present form. We addressed questions to various members of the boards and the professions and earlier this fall, but it was without this particular piece of legislation. Now, I don't have any response indicating a group that is totally negative, but certainly I'd be deceiving you if I told you that this is 100% supported, because it is not. Some say that they don't feel that it's necessary, it doesn't look like it'll do any harm, but that certainly isn't support. Others say that they still are opposed to it. They can't see where this type of interference is, and they consider it interference, is going to accomplish any public good and will more than likely accomplish nothing but public bad. My comment concerning that was only that whereas before the opposition appeared to be complete and total, we now have groups that are coming back, or individual members of various professional groups that are saying, doesn't look like it's going to do us any harm. It's coming. We'd a lot rather take care of it in-state, in-house, than let the Federal Trade Commission move in and set down either, you know, throw out all guidelines or establish its own. So, and I think there are some members of professional groups here this morning, and they'll do a much better job of presenting their point of view and their concerns than I.
Well, let me ask this question, you've got in line 12, occupational or professional licensing agency, okay? You make a distinction between occupations and professions. Would you say that the opposition that still exists is primarily among professionals rather than among people who engage in what's commonly called occupations? Let's say a barber might be an occupation, right? Or a beauty shop, you know, a beauty operator. But people like that are generally not opposing it, where lawyers, doctors, and dentists are more likely to be opposing it still.
Probably. Except I'm really not sure that I can make that statement.
All right. I just wondered if we had any kind of a generalization.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is there going to be someone testify on behalf of professionals or occupationals, and if so,
sure,
I don't want to make a comment if they're not.
And there's several people here, I think, who may be testifying.
I was going to give some sort of slipshod testimony.
I can tell you, in response to Mr. Parr's question, I'm a licensed professional engineer, belong to professional engineering societies, surveying societies, and although I don't know if there's any, I don't recognize anybody here that's by sight that probably is representing those groups. I know I have belonged to those groups long enough to know that they would very strongly oppose this type of legislation, and if we're going to get down to that, I think that we might want to hear some testimony from those people.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, Ms. Andrews. So you will better understand my question. I understood you to say that you had no real move from the consumer to encourage you to draft this bill. Did I hear that correct?
I think you heard that correct, sir, as far as Alaskan consumers are concerned, yes.
Well, now, I have heard very vocal response from consumers regarding one professional society always aimed toward, for God's sakes, clean up your act. And in effect, the consumers that have talked to me have indicated they would like the medical profession and association to police itself a little bit more firmly. Isn't this really running countercurrent to what consumer is asking for?
Just
relaxing the ability for professional associations to clean up their act. Isn't that countercurrent to what people want?
May I ask what is meant by clean up your act?
To kick out of the Alaska Medical Association the doctors that practice malpractice.
I don't know that that is necessarily related to advertising, or being allowed to set out, you know, specialties or your fees.
You're beginning to erode the ability of professional groups to police their own groups. You're just the beginning, and you're just tippy-toeing into this.
I don't think that I'm prepared to say that's, you know, an untrue statement, sir. It is certainly would constitute a relaxation of regulation in these fields.
Well,
it's sort of none of my
business, but I do have a real warm spot in my heart for a physician. I see this is sort of aimed at economics, and it's got nothing to do with cutting or prescribing or treating. I guess it is sort of, the state is just sticking its nose into the profession. I don't think there's any doubt about that, but I don't think in the way that, you know, in the cleaning up, you know, in the professional substantive matter. But I'm no doubt tipping my hand on my bias.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Mr. Chatterton's concern. Happy to relate to some of the members of this committee. Finally, there are some doctors who, in addition to complaining about other provisions of the law, have finally read the malpractice bill we passed last year and found all the wonderful things we put in helping police their cutting and prescribing. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to address myself to the witness on one matter with regard to the same hearing I talked about earlier. You talked about other agency and you cited the bar. It's my understanding, and I think it is the law, that since the court bar fight in 1963 and 64, that the bar, the organized bar, does not regulate lawyers. The organized bar is something slightly better than a country club organization that organizes conventions once a year. The Supreme Court has the power to regulate the attorneys and has taken the power, and it took it in a rather tactless, probably legal way, saying it's something that, among other things, resulted in the representative of the court standing with the state trooper beside him commandeering all the funds of the Alaska Bar Association, the National Bank of Alaska, one afternoon in the summer of 1964. That fight is fought and has been determined over a long period of time, except to the extent that the Bar Association sets up, with the permission and instruction of the court, things like grievance panels pursuant to rules promulgated by the court, the arbitration group pursuant to rules promulgated by the court according to standards set by the court. The organized bar is not an agency that regulates anyone, and the only authority that regulates attorneys is the Supreme Court. And it bothers me that this language here, at least as it stands, might be interpreted loosely to involve the courts, at least to the extent that we might start all over again with some kind of a resurrecting that hideous, rather childish fight between the lawyers and the judges. And I would like to hear from a member of the Attorney General's office, maybe hearing for this committee. Unfortunately, I'm going to be next to practicing law.
We have a representative from Attorney General's office.
Chopping at the bit right here somewhere?
Just dying to get out.
Dying to get out there? Okay, to find out what they have to say. But in addition, I'm going to be really evil and admit that I'm sitting here with two hats, because in addition to being a member of the Alaska Bar Association, also member of the Institute of Electronics.
May I make just one comment to Mr. Chatterton? I discussed this legislation with Dr. Tom Stingle yesterday. He called me. He is president of the state medical board, and he did allow me to quote him directly, which is that he felt that there would be no problem with this legislation from the standpoint of most of the members of that profession. But at any rate, but I will say, however, that I don't think he polled most of the other members either. So it is a personal opinion, at least of the chairman of the state medical board. Okay.
Do you have a question? Well, I just wanted to ask Fred before we have the attorney general representative. If this is already in case law, and if we don't have the jurisdiction, and it doesn't mention specifically attorneys or the court, how then does it apply?
Before you get through it, Will. I saw it happen last year.
Let's listen to the attorney general.
Okay.
Looking forward to this. My name is Bruce Patello, and I am with the attorney general's office, and my intent in being here today is basically to try and outline some of the legal problems that we see should Alaska not go the route of a bill similar to the one before the committee today. Generally speaking, the prohibitions against advertising have been subject to attack on three bases. The first has been federal antitrust. Sharon alluded to the Goldberg decision dealing with bar minimum fee schedules. There has been some attacks in some jurisdictions on state antitrust matters, and I think our department would take the position that our own state antitrust statute might well apply, though there is, of course, the argument on the other side that the professions being regulated industries would not be subject to the state antitrust statute. The major attack, though, has been on First Amendment grounds, and the leading case, as Sharon indicated, was the Virginia Board of Pharmacy case, where the court held that there was a right to advertise prices of pharmaceutical products. Right now, approximately 3 or 4 weeks ago, Supreme Court heard arguments in a case entitled Bates versus the Arizona State Bar. The issue in that case is whether there is a right on the part of attorneys to advertise legal services. And we're expecting a decision sometime probably before the end of the legislative session. There has been a lot of activity in lower federal courts right now dealing with, again, the medical profession, the legal profession, particularly in Virginia, interestingly enough. In these cases, the lower courts have struck down specific restrictions on advertising by both physicians and lawyers, and these cases are on appeal. Take a look at some of the specific repeals. Yeah, right.
Do you have the sites?
No, I don't. I'd be glad to supply them later to the committee. If you were to look at some of the specific sections right now in the Alaska statutes, the pharmacy chapter in Title 8 that does impose a prohibition on advertising, specifically answered by the case in Virginia Board of Pharmacy, is probably unconstitutional. The suit that Sharon alluded to that the state of Alaska is involved in right now, Ferdinand versus the Board of Dispensing Opticians we've right now reached a stipulated stay, having concluded that Bates would be dispositive in that particular case. Already, the attorneys general in three states have ruled similar provisions in their statutes to be unconstitutional. The prohibition on the part of opticians from advertising prices related to the services or products which they dispense.
And they applied the Virginia case on prescription drug advertising to?
Right. Virginia Board of Pharmacy case has pretty much been extrapolated to most of the professions where there have been attacks. At any rate, I think that gives just a very brief overview. I think the trend is very clearly to strike any bans, outright bans, on professional advertising. Again, it should be noted that the bill itself does not preclude an agency or a professional association from imposing reasonable restrictions.
This bill, you heard the discussion of Representative Brown and his
yes.
concerns and stuff. Are we constitutionally infirm, with the court, the Supreme Court, and the regulation powers vis-a-vis the Bar Association in this bill?
I'd say, looking at the case law, that I would suspect the Supreme Court would probably conclude that this would not be binding on them.
Yeah, does it say it's supposed to be binding?
I don't see it there, though I think it might well be inferred. That's correct.
And then involved besides that, some unfortunate litigation which could result in that kind of situation. I do not want to sound 1,000% negative on this thing. I'd like to find out. I've been through a bloody battlefield called an election and a few other things trying to keep the business alive, and I haven't been as involved in the activities of the Alaska Bar as I would like to have been the last 2 years old. I hear roughly what's happened. I know that the matters, particularly relating to advertising, have been discussed, and I know that they're somewhere along the way addressing exactly the same issues for the many legal reasons you've discussed here, but do you know where they are right now? Are they going to recommend a rule of court to the Supreme Court, or is the Supreme Court doing it on its own motions or committee dealing with it?
I understand that the Board of Governors met last week, and one of the items on the agenda dealt generally with advertising. I don't know specifically what was considered there or what the outcome was.
Could you find that out?
Okay, I'll attempt to do so.
Because I just have a vague memory of being told that there was something rather concrete happening in this area that might result in a rule of court that would accomplish for the lawyers what this bill would accomplish for the professionals. And of course, my only complaint is just worrying about the procedure and the prerogatives of both the legislature and the court. And I'd like to find out what you think.
Mr. Chairman.
I have two questions. Yes, Mr. Brown seemed to feel that even a bill passed by the legislature with a two-thirds vote to change the rule of court would not have any effect on the Supreme Court's authority to make these rules for the Bar Association. Do you share that view?
I don't feel prepared to comment on that particular rule or his comment, his position on that. I really am not prepared to comment. My understanding is that would be binding, or at least the court has deferred to the legislative two-thirds vote on rules, proposed rules. I don't have any reason to believe that they would act one way or the other.
Okay. The second question, Mr. Chairman, is since presumably if such a thing, a conflict arose, and of course the state Supreme Court might rule in its own favor, there's always a possibility. I'm not being disparaging here, it's just, could easily happen. But then could not the state, if ever the case, take this to federal court and get a federal court decision as to whether the Supreme Court could rule, could do that or not?
I think, first of all, I think most of maybe your question will be mooted by the Bates decision, which we expect this spring. As to the constitutionality of a ban by any bar association or instrumentality of a state on professional advertising.
Even whether it's a state Supreme Court.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Right?
Following up just what was indicated in Mr. Carr's question and the answer, I don't have it in front of me, but I know there's a case of it right here, but under Article 4, Section 15 of the Supreme Court of the Constitution of the State of Alaska, as these three of you have heard me say several times before, it says the Supreme Court shall make and promulgate rules governing the administration of all courts, that's a period. And there's another sentence saying, it shall make and promulgate rules governing practice and procedure in civil and criminal cases in all courts. These rules may be changed by the legislature by 2/3 vote of the members elected in each house. My understanding is that this is interpreted so that the ability of the legislature to change a rule applies only to the second sentence. It shall make and promulgate rules governing practice and procedure in civil and criminal cases. It does not relate to the first sentence, which relates to the promulgation of rules governing the administration of all courts. And unless I remember wrongly, I believe there's a specific case on the subject. And of course, the Supreme Court has always said that its rulemaking power in governing the bar comes from that first sentence. And that therefore, under that view, we could not section of Alaska statutes, because since there is no attempt to show any kind of a change of a rule of court under this section, the cases say specifically that there will never be any implied change in the rule of court. The legislature must do it specifically, even if you were in favor of a different view than I do. So under either view, mine or yours, Mr. Bradley, right now this current bill could not change the rules of court relating to the regulation of lawyers.
Well, we're in agreement, then we can put the attorneys off and
I like their point. I don't believe the sentence Mr. Brown read out has anything at all to do with lawyer advertising. He's talking about the administration of courts. And to me, administration of courts is in what appears in the Fairbanks Daily Newsminder are two separate things. But not being an attorney, however, Mr. Brown, to use my say, a famous phrase of the last 2 years, I will defer to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that might be a good rule, but it's not the rule that the courts in several states, including this one, have adopted. They say that anything regarding the regulation of lawyers is involved with the administration of the court system, and that's where they get their power to have the inherent power under the public bar.
Do you have any more questions for Mr. Patel?
Are there any other? Does the Attorney General's office see any problems with this aside? Let's leave the attorneys out as a separate breed of cat. Is there any, are there any other problems you see?
No, I think, in fact, those of us working in antitrust and in the consumer protection also support the bill. We see it as being, again, furtherance of consumer interests. And, of course, from an antitrust standpoint, would moot any attack that we would otherwise be forced to take ourselves.
You stimulated the question. You say in consumer interests, and I've heard the testimony here that consumers haven't come to you. You are guessing at the consumer view?
Oh, I think one could infer, number one, from the suit that is brought by consumers in the Ferdinand case, the dispensing opticians is a specific example where our office is in direct right now in direct contact with consumers who are demanding and asserting that they have constitutional rights to that information.
That was in Virginia.
No, the Bates, excuse me, the Ferdinand case is out of Fairbanks, right.
This isn't so much a question for you as a response to Chad, that all right? Sooner or later, my Republican colleagues are going to have to find out that I'm an advocate of the First Amendment. It may as well be now. There has been a strong consumer protest in the state in regard to the posting of prescription drug prices in pharmacies. And in fact, in Fairbanks, we ran a survey among the drug stores and found great disparity in the pricing. And in that area alone, there is interest in this kind of deregulation. And I don't view eliminating a regulation in quite the same way I view imposing one. But there has been, Chad, consumer interest in this.
Mr. Chairman, except for some people might view it picayune legal questions I was raising, I generally favor this kind of legislation. But I would like to walk a little carefully on the eggs that I've been discussing, and possibly your staff can be in touch with the Attorney General's office, and inquire of the board of the Bar Association and other people, possibly some Supreme Court clerks, to find out what they are doing. Because I have the general impression the judges and the lawyers are going to do this to themselves anyway, and we don't have to get into a fight over who's got the jurisdiction to do what and to whom and for how long.
Do you have any more specific questions for
That's
this
all
witness? Or? All right. Thank you. Who else wants to testify on this bill? Well, what I'd like to do is, why don't we hold on for a second? Is it? There are obviously some people here who want to testify who are lobbyists, and I think this is going to carry over until tomorrow, and I'd like to let those people who aren't lobbyists and who are just here to testify today so they don't have to come back tomorrow.
wanted to say that Dr. Yukness and I represent the same interest, just for your information, so.
I guess I'm a lobbyist, too.
Well, I suppose technically everybody here is.
Bill Parker's doing it.
I'm Leonard Yukness, and I represent the your state dental board. And the state dental board I consider as a consumer protection agency. I'm not sure it's had that feeling in the past, but when I accepted the position, I accepted it with the knowledge and responsibility that, in essence, it is a consumer board and not a dental board. And I see a wave of, in the dental profession that is trying to mature in response to the what's probably coming a federal prohibition of state licensing. In other words, how can one state license, how can somebody practice or graduate from a dental school in the Midwest, which is federally funded and programmed, and not be allowed to practice in the state of Alaska? The sad fact is that everybody, they all don't receive the same education. They are not, just because they graduated, they are not the type of dentist you particularly want them to have working on you. Regards to this bill, I am not against it, but I'm really not for it either. It discusses, it lays on the board the problem of outlining what reasonable advertising is. And I do see a problem there. Reasonable advertising for Cal Worthington Ford in Anchorage is kind of insulting. And to define and argue in the courts what reasonable advertising would be, I'm afraid that you might wind up with a Cal Worthington type dentist. And selling such things as selling pills and glasses, that's something very tangible. In other words, if I can save $10 on the pair of glasses I'm wearing from one optician to another, I think that's a fair deal. It's the same glass, same metal. I can look at it. I can feel it. If I can save 50 cents on a prescription item that's put out by Lilly or somebody else, I know what the pill is. It's the same pill, and it costs 50 cents less. So naturally, it's something that the consumer can put his finger on. But selling a service, be it legal or dental or medical, is really hard for the consumer. It's really hard for the consumer to judge, particularly when I have to go see a lawyer for anything. I realize how the patient feels when they go to the dentist or the physician. You're really in a different ballpark. It's really an intangible thing. And I wonder if the vast percentage of Alaskans are going to be able to discern from a really violent advertising dentist just how good his dentistry is. Because it's pretty easy, speaking as a practicing dentist, it's pretty easy to have something last in the mouth for a year or two. And Alaska, I think, is really vulnerable to carpetbaggers. It'd be easy to come up here for 2 years, do slipshod dentistry, and then run off. You have no, the patient has no recourse, probably through the dental board or attorneys, I'm sure, to chase this guy down. In fact, right now we have already two advertising dentists in Alaska who aren't even licensed in the state. And they put their ad in the yellow pages of the Anchorage telephone book, and this is something we're going to be discussing in our board meeting in the next few days. What recourse does the patient have through the state if they get ripped off by somebody in Seattle? I don't know. You know, this is going to be an interesting discussion. There's no, my feeling is, in talking to a lot of my lawyer friends, and I do have lawyer friends, is that
We won't hold it. Is that there's no doubt that the federal rules against advertising for the professions are coming. You know, we're going to be forced into advertising. But the crux of the matter is, will this state law, would the word be override a national or federal law? Would they complement one another, or would there be further confusion? I don't know. The dentist I talked to, I talked to one other board member, two other board members, and two dentists, school teacher, a couple of consumers, and upon reading the bill, there was nothing in there that they could say that was really bad, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily good. But there could be certain things in the dental advertising, such as dental fees and services book. You could put up a calendar for each year, the approximate cost of the fee that each dentist charges, the location, their specialty, their hours. But beware of the advertising dentist. That's about all I've got to say.
Could you give me some details on the case of the two dentists in Anchorage?
Okay, well, I got my new phone book, and I noticed two large ads for mail order. I think it was mail order dentures and denture repairs and stuff like this.
From
Seattle.
From Seattle.
Jeff? I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I just wanted to get on the line. Do you have a question about that?
No, I have a question about it.
Okay, mm-hmm. I wanted to get into another.
I do have a question. Yep. We want to stay on that same subject.
Go ahead.
Sir, I think this case in point that you're talking about, if we can explore it a little bit, it will help me considerably. I gather that these two people that are advertising dentures in the Yellow Pages in Anchorage or so, why your board at least is considering taking some action to negate this, to clean up your act. You don't like what's happening, is that right?
I don't like the idea that this. I would rather have it be a local dentist advertising than a, you know, because I don't like the idea of not being able to protect the consumer of the state within the state. That's what bothers me.
Well, now, if I read this bill right, or attempt to adopt, implement, or enforce, even your thought that you don't like it would become a violation of this bill.
Yeah. I think so.
Well, there's some question about whether or not you could even do anything about it, isn't there? You're only, as I assume, your board's only authorized to regulate licensed dentists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the
law says you cannot practice in the state without having a dental license by the state. Question is, are these men practicing in the state?
Getting on to another line, is it reasonable to assume that if somebody is licensed as a dentist in this state, then he has met some sort of minimum qualifications, in effect, the board is saying this man is a qualified dentist.
Yes.
Now, if, in fact, then licensed dentists are qualified dentists, how could that, advertising by licensed dentists lead to some fly-by-night dentist?
That's one of the fallacies of giving a dental test related on skills with the fingers. He could be a very skillful rip-off artist, and that's a shame. You know, it's deep feelings of insecurity that I have in licensing a lot of people.
Well,
but they do pass the minimum standards. You can't do a psychological workup on them.
Just a point of clarification, Doctor. So you represent the Dental Association?
I represent the State Dental Board.
State Dental Board, and they are in favor of this bill, or they don't object to this?
Two of the... this has all happened in the last 72 hours. And as far as, you know, it was sent to me, two of us are...